Hey, podcast listeners, Mike Rappin, host of the I Read Comic Books podcast here. I know this is a little weird, but we just released a survey for all you listeners out there to take. We really want to get your feedback on the show, so if you have a moment, head over to ircb.us/survey and give us some info. That's ircb.us/survey. Anyways, I'll get out of your hair, and let's get on to the show. This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I am your host, Mike Rappin. With me this week are two of my favorite friends in the entire world that I love to talk about comic books with, Paul Jaisley.
Hello.
And Nick White.
Hey, guys.
Thank you both for joining me this week. I'm super excited that you're here because we're talking about something that's really exciting and really important to comic books. But before we get to all that, I'm going to ask you the question I ask every single week. How have you been, and how have comic books been for you? I'm going to kick this over to Paul first.
Okay, well, I've been doing well because I read a lot of great comics this week. I had to kind of play catch-up this week. I had a giant stack of single issues towering precariously on my desk, and if I didn't read through them all, they were going to fall over and crush me probably while I was sleeping. So I got through as many of them as I could this week, and a couple I want to point out because I really enjoyed the artwork and some of the art choices that the artist made, namely Killer Be Killed number 2. This is the new Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips book. I've talked about issue 1 a few episodes ago. And issue 2 is exposition heavy. A lot of explaining the concept of the book, you know. Still.
Yeah.
But I really like the way Sean Phillips handled that. Rather than just having a bunch of caption boxes all over the page, there's a couple of moments where he'll split the page in two, and the left-hand side of the page will be like the character's internal monologue, what he's thinking, and the right-hand side of the page will be just three static images that sort of correlate there. So it's like he's splitting up the internal monologue and the action of the book on the page. It's really cool. I've never really seen him do stuff like that before, and it's interesting someone that has such a definitive style try something new like that. I really thought it was cool.
Yeah.
Also, I enjoyed the artwork on Wonder Woman number 6. This is one of the, you know, sort of origin issues. The even numbered issues are telling the new rebirthed origin of Wonder Woman. Greg Rucka on writing it, and Nicola Scott on pencils. And this was the issue where Wonder Woman finally comes to America. She brings Steve Trainor back to man's world, you know, after he crashed on Paradise Island. So there's a lot of moments in this issue where people are talking to Diana, but she doesn't speak English, and the people talking to her don't speak the form of ancient Greek that she's speaking.
Oh, fun.
And Nicola Scott's sort of the ways that she draws Diana's face, Wonder Woman's face, is this very kind, pleasant, I don't know how to describe it, it's just a calming presence to her, even though she's this, you know, big, powerful woman. And just the facial expressions and the way that she was sort of to express her ideas or what Diana was thinking without using words was really amazing. I mean, Nicola Scott is just tremendous on this book. So at least on these issues that she gets to do. I also read a bunch of other DC stuff. Batman number 7 and Nightwing number 5. These are the first two parts of the new Night of the Monster Men crossover happening. I dug it. I don't know. I was going to sit out the crossover, but I've been enjoying the Batman books so much, Batman and Detective Comics, that I figured I might as well give Nightwing a shot. And it's big monsters in Gotham, and Batman's got to get all the help he can to fight them. It's pretty standard comics that really sort of hit the right bat button for me. To put it that way, I guess. So
Paul, would you say that you have to read the other books like Nightwing and Detective Comics to get the whole story? Because I think I'm only going to be reading Batman.
That was exactly what I was going to ask.
Based on these first two issues, it seems like you might be missing out if you skip the other parts. I don't think it's a very big crossover, though.
Okay. There's your poll quote, everyone. Paul Jaisley. You might be missing out.
You might be missing out. I mean, I don't know. I mean, this is the first part. I hadn't read any issues of Nightwing before this, and I had no problem just following it. So there's that. You know, I don't think you have to. If you just pick up issue number 5, Nightwing, you won't be lost. It follows right after Batman number 7. So,
did it feel like there was a real effort to make it an accessible and also approachable and yet well-integrated tie-in? Or was it like Nightwing looking up and there's like the bat signal in the air and he goes, oh shit, and then he just goes on to like doing whatever he was up to anyway?
No, because I mean, in Detective Comics, and it was interesting, so Batman, you kind of have Batman on his own. Detective Comics, there's like a bigger group, a bigger cast, and Nightwing's not a part of either of those books, but because this event is so huge, I mean, there's two story tall monsters crashing around Gotham, destroying buildings. Like, it's pretty unavoidable that any of the Batman books that take place in Gotham are going to have to deal with it. So it's not right. This sort of, you know, just a loose tie-in. Like, it very much is part of the same story. So sorry, you're going to have to buy a couple extra comics this month if you want to keep up with it, but I think they're good books. Like, I enjoyed reading it, so I don't have any regrets having to pick up a few extra issues, I think, so.
Yeah, unfortunately, I shouldn't say unfortunately. Fortunately, I think that this crossover is really cool, and it ties directly into what Batman's been building since issue number one.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I'm almost willing to take the hit and read these other books simply because I want to see this monster of a story that they're putting together. I think it's going to be really, really good. And that pun was 100% intended.
Well done, Mike. Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's well worth checking out. If you've been enjoying Batman, at least, I think you'll get a kick out of the rest of the stuff. Speaking of DC and Batman, I also read Trinity Number One, which is the new series by Francis Manapul. And this was really good. It was basically Bruce Wayne and Diana Prince, Batman and Wonder Woman, being invited to dinner by Lois Lane. They go to Smallville to meet with the new Superman, who emerged at the end of the New 52. And they just have dinner, and they talk, they tell stories, and it's drawn by Francis Manapul, and it looks lovely. So if you're a DC fan, I highly recommend checking this book out. Some deep sort of references to older Silver Age stuff that I really enjoyed as a lifelong DC fan. So I enjoyed that. And speaking of DC, one more time, Superman number 7, I read this week, and it's probably one of the best single Superman issues I've read in years. I feel like as a Superman fan, part of my job, in a sense, is to tell the people why Superman is great. You know, because he is sort of viewed
at this point in time. Yeah.
Have you ever thought to yourself, gee, Paul, why do I have to keep asking and telling and reminding people why Superman is great? Why am I in this constant state of like full-on 24/7 Superman apologetics?
Well, it's not a job I take lightly, Nick. I take it very seriously.
Oh, believe me. I'm aware.
No, I thought this was really good. I mean, I know Superman is kind of viewed as a corny character, but there's sometimes just these single issues where you reminded, like, he's a good, pure-hearted character, and you kind of need that. You need somebody that's just going to always do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. Yeah, he's kind of a square, but That's all right, because he does the right thing at the end of the day. This was basically just the new Superman and his wife Lois and their son John. They go to the state fair, you know? Superman's like, you know, I'm not going to be Superman today. I'm just going to go be a part of the community, be a part of Smallville, and go to the state fair, ride some roller coasters, you know, just be a regular guy. And it was just a great story. I just really enjoyed it. So overall, the Superman series with this Rebirth title has been very, very enjoyable as a Superman fan, and I think it's a good introduction to the character, specifically this issue. So that's the highlights from my week, I guess.
Well, I do have a quick question for you, Paul. Yeah. You mentioned this briefly, and I don't think what I'm about to ask is spoilery, because it's been a couple months, and so I feel like in the interest of approachability, you said that this is the new Superman. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Is this the Superman that spun out of the Superman Lois and Lane book, which spun out of Convergence?
I believe so. I wasn't reading a lot of that stuff at the time.
Who the heck was?
Yeah, just too much.
As listeners, if you are the people who were reading that, take this as a moment to not be insulted by us and actually use it to inform us, please.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, as far as I can tell, this is, if not that, it is the pre-Flashpoint Superman that returned, and the new 52 Superman died. So
I was going to ask, what happened to him?
See, I skipped out on stuff. I wasn't reading The Last Days of Superman at that point. I was reading Action Comics. And
that was the only one I read.
Okay.
They kind of dealt with it very tangentially. They didn't really get too deep into it. So, I mean, but I was able to kind of pick it up and just read it. I mean, as long as you know that this is a different Superman than the one that was in the new 52, and they address that. I mean, in Trinity, both Batman and Wonder Woman show up and like, look, we're kind of nervous. Like, we don't really know you. We knew the old Superman and you look a lot like him and you have the same powers, but we don't know you personally. So it's kind of this interesting dynamic going on with the Superman titles and the larger DC titles because of that change. So, and really, I mean, Superman and even Trinity, the focus on his son, the new Superboy, was really great. Like, I really like that character a lot. So I recommend that stuff. If you want to read a good Superman story, I think now is the time to jump on.
Cool.
So you don't think Trinity is like superfluous at all? It sort of has its own kind of role and niche, and it's well carved out, because I always get nervous when you have like 9 books with Batman and it's like all of you, please clearly define your roles, because...
Well, yeah, I mean, based on the first issue, I enjoyed the first issue, at least, as a story. And, you know, Frances Manapul, I don't know, I mean, it looks lovely. I think his record as a writer maybe isn't great. I didn't really enjoy his Flash stuff that he was doing.
Spot on. Couldn't agree with you more.
But, I mean, but you, again, I have to just say, like, I'm just a sucker for that stuff. When you have those three characters together just sort of shooting the shit, talking about the Silver Age, you know, references and stuff, that's right up my alley. I mean, I'm not, that, there's no way I'm not going to enjoy that. So it might be a little niche audience, but I enjoyed the heck out of that first issue.
Cool. Nick, what did you read this past week?
Well, I read quite a bit, although if you want, once you listen to what I read, it feels like Nick White proudly reading the stuff that most of you read a couple weeks ago and still wants to talk about it, and now it's not relevant. So here you go. Let me tell you about Batman 28 from the New 52. No, I'm just kidding. Woo! Close one. So first off, I feel like it doesn't need to be defended, but I did read All-Star Batman number 2. I thought it was great. I still find myself liking Junior's artwork a good amount on this book, and I keep having to get into some weird brain gymnastics attempting to figure out why. I think I finally cracked the code on this one, and I do have to believe that it's honestly Danny Meekie's inking, who was inking, I think, most of Snyder's Batman run. Paul, am I right? I thought Jonathan Glapion was on there at one point, but... I think it was Meekie for the most part.
If I remember correctly, yeah.
I think Glapion was like maybe the full Court of Owls run. Anyway, and Dean White's colors. And I really like what they're doing with All-Star Batman right now, because it really is a simple inversion of Batman going from being the hunter to being the hunted. And that happens so infrequently. You know, Batman always has a plan. Batman is always going after someone. No one's really ever going after Batman, because guess what? Like, he hides his identity and he hides all of his bases and et cetera, et cetera. But here, you know, he's the hunted, and it's also kind of fun because Batman has always been known for having this really robust rogues gallery, and isn't it kind of fun and interesting that he has all of these people to go after? Well, guess what? Now that's been inverted too, as well, and now there's 18 million different people coming out of the woodwork with all sorts of some stupid and some, you know, actually dangerous abilities that want him dead. And I really, I think for me, the most fascinating part, at least from a narrative standpoint, is sort of this philosophical discussion about the wheel and this training process with Duke, and the idea that, you know, this training is something, you know, different. And honestly, like, I want to know how they're going to get out of what they do on the last page of that issue, because that seemed very final. That looked very like there were no two ways to read that panel. So I thought that was interesting. I also read 4001 AD War Mother, which was one of the four one-shots that accompanied 4001 AD as an event for Valiant. It was definitely not as weird as the Shadow Man one, and perhaps more relevant to the actual events that took place in 4001 AD, to the extent that I wouldn't be shocked if this character finds her way into the ongoing series of Rai, which I believe is continuing in the next couple months. And if anything else, it was a nice shot in the arm for Valiant to get another sort of strong female protagonist. I hate to use that tried and tired phrase, but it still remains quite true with this character, when there have obviously been, you know, accusations that things can get a little bit sausage festy, if you will. I also read Briggsland number 1. This is a Dark Horse original. Again, I honestly can't say it enough. Dark Horse has done an amazing job of reinventing themselves in the last year, pulling in top-tier talent, telling them they can do whatever they want. It's not a surprise to me that this book has already, you know, been snatched up by AMC, and they're developing it. And it's sort of, you know, as the summary says, I think that, you know, summarizes it best. Briggsland, nearly 100 square miles of rural wilderness, contains the largest anti-government secessionist movement in the United States. When matriarch Grace Briggs wrests control of the operation from her incarcerated husband, she sparks a war within the community and her immediate family that threatens to bring the full power of the federal government down on their heads. And when you read this first issue, you can just see in your head how easily this would just flat out just translate to TV. So Mm-hmm. Excited for that.
Who was on the art for that book?
Gosh, what was his name? It was Mac something. Right. No, Brown is busy working with Wood as well, but he's working on that Viking book that I can't think of the
right.
name.
Oh, right. Right, right, right.
But beyond that, I did finally get to read Killer Be Killed number one. I know I'm a little bit late to the party on that. I will say this. I do think it is the best looking collaboration of Brubaker and Phillips and Brett Weiser, in my opinion. It is their best looking book so far.
Absolutely.
And I was telling Mike yesterday, I think what's unique about this book is that while these guys have always told these very interesting stories, and many of them have been period pieces with a twist, and they're very great at aping different visual styles from, you know, certain eras, I've never really found a lot of their characters to be like relatable or something that, you know, people can sort of see a bit of themselves in.
Totally.
Yeah.
And yet I think with this book, sort of the... you know, the lulls in depression that this character goes through, and sort of these like sentiments of, you know, feeling a terrible person, or this idea that, you know, in the first issue, you know, he gets saved or redeemed, but he, you know, seems to like not have a direction in his life for a while. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think there were aspects and elements of this character that I think a lot of people, you know, especially younger people growing up and whatnot, and, you know, having different struggles or whatnot, can relate to. Mm-hmm. Better than some of their other characters. But amazing design in this book. The way that, how do I tiptoe around this? The way that the twist element in this book is designed, I think the design of the twist element is magnificent.
Yeah.
You know, how it's just this sort of blurry, blackish thing with these like almost chalk-like outlines that work their way around it. And for those of you who haven't read this book, you're in for a treat. I honestly think this is one of their more approachable titles. And the argument that, you know, they only do period pieces, or that their stuff seems a little bit trapped, or even that Criminal felt a bit dated in certain ways, I think this book is simultaneously timeless and yet a bit more modern in its pacing and whatnot.
Yeah.
But the final book I want to talk about, either of you, I mean, do you guys have any other further comments on that book? I think both of you have read it at this point, so.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we talked about it on another episode.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I won't go any further than that. I know we talked about it. Otherwise, I'm going to just start jumping right into the spoilers of the book, so it's fine.
Here's what happens in issue two, Nick. Fuck.
It is pretty amazing to see some people that work so well together. I mean, Brubaker and Phillips, I mean, they just get better and better, which is...
Yeah.
Surprising. It's great to see. It's always nice to see them just try new stuff. So yeah, anyway.
But the final book I want to talk about is Britannia number one. This is Valiant's newest entry in the, what is this one called? Future of Valiant. That's they name all of their launch arcs, if you want to call it that. So this is Peter Milligan and Juan Jose Reap. Milligan writing, Juan Jose Reap on art. Milligan should be a pretty familiar name to a lot of our readers. He's been around for a long time, and he's had his paws on a fair amount of relatively well-known books, all the way from Justice League Dark to Hellblazer. I think he did...
Ecstatics.
Mm-hmm. Whichever one had Dupe, the X-Men book.
Yeah, Ecstatics.
Dupe.
Yeah. Okay.
That was him.
With Mike Allred.
So he's been around for a while. He's dabbled all around the big two for quite a bit. And to be honest, he's not really been, I guess I should say I haven't really been in his corner for a fair amount of those years. Mm-hmm. And Juan Jose Reap did the art for Clone. But this book is really, really interesting, and I super enjoyed it. If you're the sort of person that likes, I guess what you would call, like historical fiction with a little bit of a supernatural bent, this is definitely it. It takes place in 60 AD, where you have this character named Antonius Axia, and he is asked by this Vestal Virgin, which I guess all of you can go look that stuff up. I'm sure the two of you have a vague idea what that's about, but, you know, there were these women that held positions of power back in the days of the Roman Empire, and they kept this sacred flame burning, and I don't want to wander on about that because I'm probably going to say some things that are wrong, but anyway, they held positions of power, and they send this guy to go rescue one of their fellow Vestal Virgins who's been kidnapped by this weird, like, cult. And the book almost gets kind of Cthulhu-y because he, sure enough, like, there's this weird cult and they're about to sacrifice her. And this guy breaks in and he, like, kills all the bad dudes and then realizes that, like, maybe all of these weird rumors about this cult, like, communing with this monster are real. And he sort of goes insane and has to, like, get rehabilitated. And yet, 6 years later, he's being asked to go to Britannia and investigate these, like, you know, Britannia, all the way on the outlier of the Roman Empire's, you know, outposts and whatnot, and investigate these weird claims mm-hmm. that maybe these monsters are more real than not, or that, you know. I don't want to give too much away, but it is, if you like books that are, like, sort of gory and scary, and have, you know, some sort of a historical bent, I would definitely recommend this. And it's only 4 issues. I don't know if they're going to find a way to rope this in to the larger Valiant universe. I said the same thing with Divinity, and then finally with Divinity issue number 3, finally they brought in the rest of the Valiant universe, so they'll find a way.
Gotcha. What really interests me about this book is that Juan Jose rips on this book. The Juan Jose Rip? I want to say his name properly at least once.
I always say Reap.
Reap. It was an Avatar title that he did with Warren Ellis called No Hero. Mm-hmm. And it was like one of the most gruesome books I've read. And it was right when I started to really start branching out into comics that weren't just the big two, specifically weren't just Marvel. And I remember I was at C2E2. Not C2E2, I'm sorry. I was at Wizard World Chicago back when the big two were still going to that. And there was this thing, and there were Avatar was all over the place pushing this book, No Hero, No Hero, No Hero, Warren Ellis and Juan Jose Reap. And I was like, what is this book? And I remember just being perplexed by the look of the mm-hmm. cover, because it looks very much like a punk rock, like, magazine stuck together with, like magazine clippings and stuff, like a serial killer's note almost. Uh-huh. And Warren Ellis was there, and at the time I stood in line for 3 hours trying to see Brian Michael Bendis, and over my shoulder was Warren Ellis with like a handful of people talking to him, and I missed my chance. This is before I knew who Warren Ellis was. And of course I ended up picking up that book thinking, oh, the artist and the writer are gonna be here. And it turns out they were only gonna be at the convention for like 3 hours and I missed my chance. But I read that Zero issue for that book and got hooked on it, and boy, it gets crazy out there. Blowing up everything, blood and guts and gore and just tortured, mutilated human beings. That's what I remember Juan Jose Reap's art for. So to say that he's on, like, I know that I looked at his Wikipedia earlier, to know that he's done big two work and that he's doing work like this, I'm like, it's got to be nasty stuff then.
Yeah, I think.
Or maybe it's toned down a little bit. I don't know.
Not really. I think probably one of his best suited works is that Stephen Grant and Juan Jose Reap adapted what was, I think, Frank Miller's original screenplay for what was supposed to happen with, I believe, Terminator 2. Hmm. Don't quote me on this. And holy cow. Like, if you want to talk about gore, murder, evil doing, terrible looking people heaven, that would be that book. And he was a perfect okay. pairing for that. And yeah, I don't know if I could recommend that book if you ever want to think nice thoughts ever again. So,
I see.
Anything else, Mike?
Well, no. I was just going to go into what I read recently, because all I've been doing recently is reading manga. I stay up too late, and I just read volumes of Bleach mm-hmm. over and over and over, because I wanted to just hate myself for a while. And those books are super easy to read, and so I've been mixing comic books in with manga, and since I've been reading on a tablet, I've been swiping the wrong direction to go forward in my sure. Western comics, which is really problematic reading Batman, and I get through a page and I swipe backwards and I go, wait, didn't I just read this? This seems new. Wait, mm-hmm. no, it's not new. But I actually did read some comics. On Wednesday of last week, I did buy 7 to Eternity number 1, and I'll talk about that in a minute while I get through the rest of these. So I read The Wicked and Divine One-Shot, which is Kieran Gillen and Stephanie Hans. This book was very beautiful. A lot of people liked it. I know Tia really liked it. She wrote an article on the Mary Sue about it. I didn't understand it until the very last 2 pages. I think I need to reread that entire series or something. I feel like I'm missing a piece of the relevancy there. But it's very beautiful, and it ties into the rest of the story. Like, I get where the characters are coming from. I kind of understood what was happening. I don't know if the end of the issue was like a precursor for what's going to happen in the next volume of the series. But ultimately, I was really, really lost, and it was hard to keep track of the characters for a little bit. So I think it deserves a reread, but it's a very beautiful book. Like, Stephanie Hans's art is, it is up there. I read All New Wolverine number 12, which is a Civil War II tie-in. I won't go too far into it because it was a cop-out issue, and I was really mad at the end of it. It's not that the story was really phoned in, but the ending was so circular. Like, it's so just a Wolverine story, and it's like they aren't really trying to break out of the mold of what a Wolverine story is. And that was a little disappointing because I think up until this point, the creators that have been on this team have done a fantastic job. The art in this issue was really, really lackluster in comparison to the previous 11 issues. So I don't know. I'm kind of bummed about this series because I really, really like it. I'm hoping that this was just an off issue because of the tie-in. Like, I realized that the tie-in to Civil War II was kind of forced. It works, but not everyone has a future that you can premonition or whatever. I won't go into it any further than that. It was kind of an annoying story arc, and I'm glad that it's done. I also read Batman number 7, which we already kind of talked about, and I read a few other books, but I also read The Backstagers number 1 finally. Issue number 2, I think, just came out or is coming out very soon. This book is like a love letter to anyone that has been in theater, has done theater, and it's a bunch of just call-outs. I was never that person, so I don't think that it's as close to my heart as it probably is for a lot of other people, but I really enjoyed it. Everything was very modern comics, like what everyone cries and screams about how comic books should be. This is what this book is bright colors, happy endings, everyone's kind of nice, but people are mean. It reminds me of Jonesy. Sorry, the bad guys are kind of mean, but they're not excruciatingly brutal to you. So it reminds me of Jonesy, and it's this very all ages kind of feel, and it's going to be a heartwarming book. I just hope it sells well. Ryan Tsai's art, is very cartoony in a good way. It's not so much like Jonesy, where it's very, very out there cartoony, but it's not like, you know, realistic, like a classic comic booky, like, you know, Jim Lee or anything. It's kind of nice in the middle. It reminds me a little bit of Adventure Time or Bravest Warriors, but less of the weird, long, crazy arm things. I don't know if I'm describing this very well. But it's a bright and colorful, and it's a lovely book. I bought it on a whim, thinking, probably not going to like this, but I at least want to give it a chance because I think there was a lot of hype around it on the internet. And it actually wasn't bad. I think I'll probably keep continuing to read this book. It's not hard to follow in comparison to, like, the Wicked and Divine book, because I read them one after the other.
Oh, my God.
So it was a very nice breath of, relief. But otherwise, let's see. I did read Seven to Eternity, and I said that I was going to be disappointed and angry, and I wasn't. Jeremy Opina's art is unbelievably good. He's so much better than what he was in Uncanny X-Force. I don't know what happened. This guy has grown tremendously. Rick Remender is still doing his character focused in a cool world type of story, but I knew that going in, so I'm not as disappointed as I thought. But the character designs and the evil bad guy-ness of this story is so overwhelmingly cool. I just got to see this through. Like, the main character is such an underdog going against these massive gods that have taken over the world. I love it. And it's probably because I've been reading so much manga, but this book totally works for me. It's like, I'm a guy who thinks he's great and I know everything, and I'm going to go fight the biggest, baddest guy there is. But
so you're saying I now have manga to blame for you getting back into Rick Remender titles?
Maybe. I've been doing this a lot lately. I've been claiming everything's like a manga, but I think that's because stories like this are all kind of the same, no matter where they come from. Sure. And so Seven to Eternity is well worth your dollar, I'll say, even at the $4 price point. Like, just the content in the back of sketches of Opina's, like, trying out a couple different styles for each of the characters and the villains is astounding. And I don't know. I think this book will be good, ultimately. And I believe it's a miniseries. If it's not, I'm going to at least continue reading this through the arc, like I've been doing for a lot of other books. I've been trying them. Like X-Men 92, I dropped that this week, and number 7 comes out.
What book did you drop?
X-Men 92. Okay. As much as I love that book, I could not deal with it anymore.
It happens. Yeah.
It's too campy. I mean, I love those characters and I love the setting that they put them in, but it just got too much. There was so many just like in jokes and nods and like winks to the camera. And I'm like, this is a comic book. You can't wink at me. I don't know.
Said no Deadpool fan ever. God.
Comic books come out this week on September 28th, 2016. Paul, what are you reading this week? What are you excited for?
Well, probably no surprise to you or Nick or anybody that's listened to this podcast before. I'm very excited for the new volume of Love and Rockets. Love and Rockets number one. This is, according to my math, the fourth volume of the legendary Love and Rockets series. This is going to be originally going to be monthly, but it turns out it's going to be more like a quarterly or three times a year book. From Fantagraphics, the previous volume of Love and Rockets was like a big 100-page annual that came out once a year. So I'm excited to get my Jaime Hernandez and Gilbert Hernandez art more regularly from Fantagraphics. I don't know how deep I should get into this because, I mean, I think everyone kind of knows Love and Rockets is an important series, whether they've read it or not.
Or at least they've heard us talk about it at some point on this show, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is a classic. It's an established, you know, indie book. It's been going on for over 30 years now, and the fact that both Jaime and Gilbert Hernandez are still plugging away and doing it is pretty amazing, and I think its reputation has only grows more important. I kind of prefer the Jaime Hernandez stories. I think that's not uncommon. His work is a little bit more approachable. Gilbert's stuff can be a little bit more experimental. But what's nice about these books is that you get their artwork side by side. When they collect the old Love and Rockets, they tend to collect just the Gilbert stories and just the Jaime stories. So I love seeing their stuff back to back, where you'll get a couple pages of a Love and Rockets, you know, Jaime Hernandez story with Maggie. And then you'll get a couple pages of some random story that Gilbert does, and it's great just to see that comparison back and forth and see how different their approaches are to comics, you know, even though they've been doing this kind of side by side for so long. So if you have been following the previous volume, Love and Rockets news stories, it left off with Maggie Chescareo and her best friend Hopi reuniting and going back to their old neighborhood where the classic Love and Rockets stories took place for a big punk rock reunion, so to speak. So it was really exciting to see those characters back together in that way. I love the fact that Jaime Hernandez has been telling the same story for 30 years. And these characters age realistically. The Maggie that we saw is when she was 16 when the book started is now pushing 50. And you can tell it's her. You've been through all the stuff with her. I just love that.
That's so weird, man. Like, it's the only so crazy. I deal with like this is Judge Dredd. And he just does the same thing regardless. Yep. So,
you know, it's. I think it might be daunting, obviously, to say, like, hey, this story's been going on for 30 years. Just jump on. But honestly, I think Jaime Hernandez is such a good storyteller that you could pick up this issue and get a feel for who these characters are and their history together, even if you never read any other stuff. And if you dig it, cool. There's 30 years worth of stories for you to go read. If you don't dig it, at least Jaime Hernandez's artwork is pretty enough to just look at, you know, whether you dig the story or not. So I'm excited for this. I think it might be good. I jumped on with the previous volume, number one, the Love and Rockets News Stories Volume 1. I had never read it before, and I was hooked immediately. So if you want an excuse to check this book out, I think this is maybe the excuse you need to check it out finally.
Man, I might have to do that this week.
Yes,
this is like, you got me hyped up, man. This is exactly this is Transformers versus G.I. Joe all over again.
Yes, that's what I do. That's what I do. I turn you on to new stuff all the time. So
Paul is just the hype man. He's great. Nick, what are you excited for this week?
For me, much like Paul, I think this book is probably not going to shock anyone that it's my pick, but it's Aliens Defiance number 5. The big reason for this, of course, is the 12-issue maxi series by Brian Wood. Big reason I'm excited for this issue is that Tristan Jones is returning to art. Jones did issues 1 and 2, and then Riccardo Bucciarelli did 3, and Tony Braschini did 4. But really, they were just not as... No offense to Bucciarelli, because obviously he's... Aside from butchering his name, he's Brian Wood's buddy from DMZ. But Tristan Jones draws the scariest, grittiest, most terrifying aliens I have ever seen. And I can tell you, for better or for worse, I've seen a lot of different artistic depictions of H.R. Giger's creature. some cute, some non-threatening, and others downright terrifying. And Tristan Jones... ones are just like these like skeletal unrelenting murder machines. So I'm really pumped to see him return. think this issue is going to be interesting because we've seen Private First Class Zula Hendricks and Davis 01, the Weyland-Yutani security drone, who apparently decided to defy his programming, whether we've decided to truly believe this or not, attempting to follow some of the paper trail that Weyland-Yutani has left and destroy some of these outposts that hold xenomorph, I don't know, samples, if you will. And in this issue, we're going to see them sort of going toe-to-toe with other colonial marines that have actually been sent out to recover the samples. And it's going to be interesting because at least with this issue, it's going to take place on like a large mining facility of sorts. Mm-hmm. So it's actually going to be like a real populated area. Whereas, as we all know, with most Aliens narratives, it's like seven people on an abandoned ship, seven people on an abandoned space station, four people trapped in their living room with an alien hiding behind the refrigerator. You get the idea. It's always like a bottleneck scenario with like six people. So the idea that it's this highly populated situation, I know it's like, Nick, these are such small, dumb twists. Nick, this is kind of like sad. Like, do you feel like Aliens has like reached its death throes in terms of, you know, narrative capability? And I'm not answering that question. I think that's not fair. And I don't
You're
want
still
to.
Buying. You're still yeah. buying it though. So yeah.
You don't understand.
Not.
There's like 70 people here. It's totally different from the last Alien story. No, it should be great. And Tristan Jones, when he's done with this, I expect him to get a lot more work, honestly.
That's exciting.
Interesting.
What about you, Mike? What's your pick?
Oh, this week is weird because I have a decent-sized poll, but I'm behind on Future Quest, so I don't necessarily want to pick that.
Yeah.
Outcast has kind of been doing its Outcast thing. Ringside, I'm behind on that. Saga, I just read, and it's kind of just been at 100% the entire time. So I picked The Flash number 7 this week because the twist that happened at the end of issue 6 was very, in my mind, classic Flash. Like, it's a classic comic book Flash twist, and I won't give it away. So I'm really excited to see where this book goes. I don't know if I really am a fan of this two-issue thing that they've been doing with artists, where they've been rotating them out instead of every other or every third or something. They've been rotating them out for two issues at a time. And it's kind of jarring because I like the depictions of one artist over another. And as soon as I get attached to one artist, they switch. And yeah. So it's really weird
to see multiple artists kind of working on the same arc. I find that very weird. I thought the whole intent with this whole DC rebirth was that each artist, a great example would be David Finch on Batman, you know. Finch was around for the whole arc, and for better or for worse, whether you liked it or not, there was a visual continuity of sorts.
Yeah. Rossmo was on this most recent issue.
This has been the case on other DC books. It's not the case with my Green Arrow book. It sounds like it's not the case with your Flash book.
Yeah, it's been weird all over the board, I think. And so the art thing aside, the story has been okay, but I'm like accepting that, like that it wasn't 100% great, but I think that it was classic. And so I'm trying to roll with that to say, like, is this what makes a good Flash story? Because, like I said, since I started reading this, I've never read a Flash comic book before. So I'm trying to go into this without being, like, a judgmental jerk about DC books, thinking, well, they're all just clunky and none of them make sense. And, of course, it's this person. Of course, it was that person who's the bad guy. Of course, this person got abducted. You know, nothing like that. So without giving too much away, I mean, I hope that doesn't spoil the story, but I don't know. I'm ready to keep going. There's this underlying story that's been going on with, it's not Wally West. What's his name? The young Flash kid who suddenly became the Flash. He like lives with Iris West. Wally West, I think,
Wally
is his
West.
Name. I don't know. Is it Wally West?
Is that Bart West?
No,
it's the old one.
It must be Wally West. I'm just getting my names confused. And that's the story that I'm really interested in, but they haven't touched on it enough. So I'm hoping that this next arc finally does, while they figure out how to resolve this whole bad guy thing, which is more than likely the Godspeed character is likely going to be the focus of this story arc, unlike the last one where he was hinted at and finally came to fruition in issue number 6. So I'm excited for this book, but I'm still hesitant. Like, I'm going to give it one more arc, I think, and then we'll see how I feel about this story. So,
interesting.
I don't know. The Flash is a weird comic book to read. I really like the TV show, and I didn't realize how similar the comics were to the TV show. Like, I was hoping.
Oh, okay.
But, like, in reading this book, it feels very, very close, and I don't know if that's good or bad yet. I have yet to decide, even after 6 issues.
It's very strange. It's weird. Yeah, I've been meaning to kind of go back and check this book out, but it's strange. I haven't read a regular Flash comic regularly in years and years, and the Flash has always been my favorite, like one of my favorite superheroes. When I was a kid, I loved the Flash because really? There was the TV show in the early 90s that I loved. Oh. And then, you know, and I wasn't reading a ton of comics back then. And then now with this, I love the new Flash series, the TV show, but I haven't really read a regular Flash comic. It's weird. I love that character, but for some reason, it's always off. The comics never quite do it for me the way that the TV show does. So I don't know.
Well, I'd say when this first trade comes out, I'd say give it a chance.
Sure.
It's not bad by any means. It's just kind of, it just feels like super classic, like tropey comic books in a way.
Okay.
And it works. It works for the most part.
Cool. Are a few weeks past it, but many comic book readers and fans across the world probably celebrated August 28th like they do every year because it's a very important date in the history of comics. It is, of course, the date back in 1917 that Jack Kirby, born Jacob Kurtzberg, was born. And this year marks the 99th anniversary of his birth. And as probably well known to anybody that's listened to this podcast a few episodes, has heard me talk about Jack Kirby. I'm a huge fan, and I think it's always important to go back and look at his influence, not just as an artist, which I might argue he's probably the greatest comic book artist of all time, chiefly because of his influence, but the larger picture of Jack Kirby. I think, as we'll talk about in this discussion we'll have honoring Jack Kirby and talking about his influence, his work and his ideas about comics pushed the industry and pushed the medium in ways that it hadn't been pushed before, both in terms of art, story, and just the idea of what comics can do, what you can do with comics. So I wanted to kind of talk about that with you guys, who I think we all have different histories with Jack Kirby. I've been a fan as long as I can remember. I think you guys are sort of more recently have started reading his stuff. So how should we start? There's so much to talk about Jack Kirby. So I guess maybe to start, I want to say, when we talk about Jack Kirby, when we talk about his influence, it's very easy just to read off or list off the characters he created.
So let's do that now.
Oh, so we'll just, here's the list. But, it is impressive, no doubt. The guy invented Marvel Comics, basically, right? But I think that diminishes his importance in some sense. Yeah, he created a lot of great intellectual property for Marvel and DC, but when you read about his history, he kind of got screwed over and didn't get recognized for that at the time. So it's kind of a sore subject. What I think is more interesting is the fact that he was pushing comics in new ways by creating these characters that had never been seen before. Yeah, the characters generate a lot of money, but they're weird concepts. When you think about Jack Kirby created Galactus, no one had done a villain like that before. He wasn't an evil mad scientist. He wasn't, a monster. He wasn't a gangster. He was like a god.
And he wasn't human.
Yeah. So, that the level that Jack Kirby pushed, not just story or art or, that's important, but I think talking about the larger implications of his work is worth the discussion. So I'll be quiet for a minute, and what do you guys think about Jack Kirby?
The thing that comes to mind about Jack Kirby when I think about it now is how much I didn't realize was him. Like, when I think about, all the prints or all the t-shirts or all the, posters or whatever you saw at conventions or you see it like Hot Topic or you see it Kohl's or wherever, you see all this art for these characters, but these iconic Marvel characters, you think of Thor, the X-Men, Captain America, Spider-Man, all of these characters were created by Jack Kirby, and they are the images that you see of them are typically Jack Kirby's images because they're so iconic. They're so like, and now they're like retro in a way, but they're so like the definitive image of what you think of these characters, and no one, unless you dive into it like we have, you don't really recognize that as Jack Kirby. You wouldn't walk down the street and go, hey, who drew that? Do you know the artist who did that? No one would be able to tell you. They would just say, well, that's Captain America. You go, well, the guy behind it is actually way more important, man. And then you sit someone down and talk to them for 10 minutes about it, and then before they've called the cops, you run away into an alley.
Yeah.
But that's something that's always struck me, that like the more and more I read about Jack Kirby, the more I realize, wow, these images have been with me my whole life. I just didn't I didn't realize they were all done by the same person. I didn't realize they all came out of the same era. I thought these were just the stock images, you know, that Marvel had. And it turns out that they are.
Yeah, they're just so ubiquitous. You're like, this is this character, you know, forever and ever. And the idea that you associate a person with it, or that maybe, you know, they didn't always look that way, it just doesn't come to mind. You're like, this is how the character started, and you're like, that's it.
But you know, not to put Kirby up on too much of a pedestal, I mean, obviously we are here a little bit, but like, there are, you know, famous works that we think about in art history, you know, and we attribute them to the artist. You know, you think of Pablo Picasso, you think of you know, Da Vinci, you think of the guy who did Starry Night, whose name is I'm blanking on right now.
Van Gogh.
You know, but when you see these images, people typically associate them with the artist. But when it comes to these iconic characters, I don't think a lot of people go, that's a Kirby, you know, by any means.
Yeah. And I think to piggyback off that point, I think what's really interesting is that people that are into comics and artists and other creators know that stuff. And when you start digging into it, it's not just the characters, but his drawing style was very different for the time. I mean, he reinvented his own style several times over his career, which, of course, his career spanned, you know, like 7 decades, so he was able to do that. But, you know, techniques, like the way he would draw cosmic energy, which is something that you can't really draw, but the way he developed these, like, squiggly lines.
Oh, the Kirby Crackle?
The Kirby Crackle. And people are still using that stuff to this day. His use of, you know...
Negative space.
And...
yeah.
The way he pushed it, no, I do collage art on my own. So when I started seeing in old Fantastic Four issues, Kirby was doing photo collages to portray the negative zone and stuff. I mean, that no one had ever done that before. And I don't think that's something people even think to do nowadays even. That sort of technique, the way he used the page itself, I don't think he was the first person to do a splash page, but he used them wonderfully. If you look at his work for DC in the early 70s, he'd do this thing where you'd have the cover and then you'd open the page and it'd be a splash page, you know, introducing the story, and then the following the splash page would be a double page spread. So the story just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's this wonderful like rhythm to his stories that people do, but it's like you said, Mike, unless you're tuned in, you might not know that it's all kind of coming from this Kirby tradition.
Totally. I think for me, the thing that stuck out the most was anyone who knows a little bit of comics probably knows a bit about the origins of Stan Lee, and if you know a little bit more than that, especially if you've heard the somewhat similar narrative on the DC side of things, you know, everyone goes, okay, so everyone says it was Stan Lee, but you know, who did he screw over, you know, to get that way? Because it seems like that's just how that narrative works, right? That archetype. And so I'd heard of Kirby before, but I think what shocked me the most was that at first you discover him and you're like, wow, he was this really influential artist, and he was sort of doing, you know, he was abstracting the medium at a time when everyone else was sort of like, look, you actually have to learn how to draw muscles and sinews, and, you know, so we can be like respectable. And I even remember there was a quote that Neil Adams had during the time that he was talking during that documentary. And
yeah, there's this hour-long documentary that's on YouTube. I'll post a link to it in the show notes. I've actually got a couple things that I'll probably post. I don't know if we'll get to them all, but they were all really influential in today's discussion, as well as some links to comics that we all tried to read or at least look at for a little bit. But the documentary that Nick is talking about is absolutely fantastic. I don't know if you have the quote ready or not, Nick.
Yeah, I got it. I got
it. Yeah, go ahead.
Anyway, it's from a Jack Kirby Storyteller, which is a documentary which is on YouTube. I'm certain. I don't know if there's a way that you can buy that if you want to, you know, throw some money at it, but it is on YouTube, so I'm sure someone's going to get compensated. And Neil Adams says,
"And I was interested in drawing. I was interested in anatomy. I was interested in perspective and all these things that a young artist is interested in, and not interested in somebody who had taken all that stuff, put it in his back pocket, and then gone on to create just total action on a page."
And I think while all of this, you know, praise for Kirby as an artist is not undue, it is, but the idea that he was just as big of a storyteller, and not just in the works that people conventionally know him for writing, such as New Gods, but the idea that he was actually really the one behind everything that was, you know, like, oh, Stan Lee saved Marvel all by himself, blah, 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 blah. Isn't that great? You know, if you read a lot of stuff, Kirby basically says, and not to split hairs, he basically says it was all me. Like, literally, mm-hmm. it was all me. Right. Stan was great at, like, knowing when the board meeting was going to be held and sending out packages. But I believe the literal quote is something along the lines of, like, Stan Lee was just an office worker at Marvel because yeah. of his cousin who ran the place or yeah. something along those mm-hmm. lines. I was like, these are bold words. This is a pretty big statement to make.
And that's something that's kind of been around in the comic industry for a while. I mean, the documentary we were talking about, I think, was made in sometime in the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's an interview that Nick sent me a piece of. Okay, so that was made in 2005. But there was a piece of an article that came out in 1990 from the Comics Journal when it was still, I think, just a magazine. Mm-hmm. And, well, I don't think it was on the internet in 1990. But nonetheless,
right.
you know, it was still just a magazine. And Kirby and his wife go into great detail about how Kirby did all the work and Stan Lee was just there. And Kirby straight up calls him out in the article. And it's there's no real, you know, paper trail. There's no real way to prove any of this. And at one point, you know, Kirby's wife even says, you know, this is just his word versus another, you know, another person's word. No one has any kind of documentation to prove any of this. But Kirby's like, no, but I want to say this right here. I want to get this on paper in one way to say I did all of the work. I created all of these characters. And Stan Lee was just there as like a placeholder. Like his name got put on all of these books, blah, blah, blah. And now we obviously should take that with a grain of salt. Because I think it was I think Paul said this in the pre-show before we started going, that it was probably a little bit sour grapes. But at the same time, like, we can't doubt this. Like, I don't think right. Kirby would claim this so much and be telling a lie. Like, he's not getting any royalties for it. He's saying it for his own pride. And to me, I don't know, I want to take his side. Like, he seems to have such a great grasp on all of these characters, the way he talks mm-hmm. about them in interviews. It's astounding. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. I think knowing what we know now about how the Marvel method worked back then, where it was Stan Lee, you know, assumedly pitched an idea for the issue to Kirby or Ditko, whoever he was working with, and then the artist would basically draw the comic with some notes in the, you know, in the side of the page of what the story was, and then Stan Lee would go in and fill in the dialogue and the caption boxes and all that. So the division of labor isn't that clear cut. I mean, a lot of the stories in Fantastic Four and X-Men, all those classic Marvel stories were written by Kirby, essentially. Maybe not the words themselves on the page, but the actual plot of the issue, what happened in the issue, was planned out by him.
Right.
And so we know that now, and you know that, I mean, that's part of what Kirby's pointing out. It's like, yeah, it wasn't just him writing it and then me drawing it. There was more of a collaborative, or as Kirby says, I did all the work. But if it is sour grapes, it's somewhat justified. I mean, Kirby didn't get credit when he was alive, really. He passed away in 94, and I think his financial compensation for his creations came just a few years ago, you know, for his family.
Yeah.
And his work for hire was, that line in his contract, he's doing this work for hire, was used to prevent him from getting royalties for years. And not only that, there's plenty of stories where they go into the legal documents and say other artists had their art returned to them after a certain amount of time. Mm-hmm. Kirby was one of the only artists at Marvel who didn't get his original pages back. Marvel owns thousands and thousands, and there are thousands upon thousands of Jack Kirby pages. He was drawing 15 pages a week in the late 60s, early 70s. Goodness. So there's so much of his artwork that he never got to own. So the sour grapes element, it's there, but it's somewhat justified. And I think the rise and awareness about creators' rights in comics and the unfairness of work-for-hire contracts, again, that's part of Kirby's legacy. He made people wear that stuff.
Yeah, that was a great point in that documentary, saying that, you know, if Kirby, when he left Marvel to go work at DC, when he did New Gods and he did all sorts of other stuff over there, some of the creators were saying that if DC or Marvel had just offered him a contract that they would later offer to artists in like the mid-80s, to him in the 70s, he would have stayed at Marvel and he would have gone on to create, you know, thousands of more pages of Fantastic Four and Captain America and, you know, all these staples at Marvel that he founded and just said, you know, I liked Thor, so I created a Thor book. You know, we did Captain America in the 40s, so we brought Captain America back. I did the Avengers. Like, he did all of these books because he loved all of these characters and he understood them. But when he left, it was, you know, it was a, please give me this or I'm going to go. And then he went over to DC where it was a little bit better, but more or less the same. And then he bounced back to Marvel eventually. Like, you guys really got to watch this documentary. It totally blew my mind.
It's very good. It's very well done. And I think, you know, that's an interesting point. What I think, though, a point I want to stress here is that we talk about these characters that you created, but there's a great interview by or quote that Mark Evaner, who was Jack Kirby's assistant in the early 70s, and by assistant, he basically just sat and watched Jack draw, and Jack told him stories. He didn't help at all.
But that's Mark Evaner basically admitted in the documentary as well.
But Mark Evaner, it might be in the documentary, it might be in the biography that Mark Evaner did about Kirby a few years ago, but he tells a story that someone made a comment that a new creator was taking over the Captain America book in like the 70s or 80s and says, well, I'm going to return it to the Jack Kirby, you know, the Jack Kirby method or the Jack Kirby style. And Jack turned to Mark Evaner and said, well, this kid doesn't get it. The Jack Kirby style, the Jack Kirby method is to create something new. It's like, I've already done Captain America stories. I'm going to do something different. So he's known for these classic characters, but you look at his legacy and what he did in the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s, he was always creating something new. He never wanted to repeat himself.
Right.
And that's pretty amazing to have that much imagination to do all that.
Yeah. So, and in that light, I mean, what kind of books would you say are probably his most creative? I know between, you know, in the pre-show, we were talking a little bit about OMAC, and we mentioned Fantastic Four and stuff, but like, what made these books, like when he went over to DC and he was getting the writer and artist credit, you know, what made these books so insane to you guys? And unfortunately, I didn't have a chance to read a lot of his DC work. I just read a little bit of the S.H.I.E.L.D. book that I happened to pick up last week. But you guys were saying stuff about OMAC before.
Nick, I'll let you, because I think you just read OMAC, and after my very enthusiastic recommendation, so I kind of want to hear what you thought of it.
Yeah, so I mean, my background here is one that's not steeped in Kirby, but I did read the Dan Didio, Keith Giffen take on OMAC from 2001 with the onset of the New 52. So it was definitely different to not see a totally like blue looking OMAC. I mean, the New 52 OMAC was almost more beast than man, whereas the old OMAC is a guy with a mohawk and gauntlets. Which
it's so cool looking though. It's like, awesome. It's awesome looking. Like it's not just a regular like punk mohawk. It's like a full fledged like piece of steel coming out of his head. I mean, that's so awesome to me.
It's awesome.
But it was a super bizarre story that I could already tell from, you know, from the beginning that this was not a book that was going to tie into anything else or play well with anything else. It was just unadulterated Kirby from beginning to end, you know, not any like publisher running interference really or any artist, you know, getting in the way of whatever he thought the vision was. And yeah, so OMAC is the one man
Army Corps, yeah.
Yeah, one man Army Corps. I should know that because I think about four different characters in every issue remind you that that's what it stands for. He truly is a one man Army Corps. Yes, he is. Yes.
That's how they round off every issue, right? It's just wow. He truly is a one man Army Corps.
He really is. Oh no, it's OMAC. What does that stand for? Don't worry, I'll tell you in the next panel. It's one man Army Corps. But all joking aside, it's this really terrifying book that begins with this, you know, one of those great exclamations that this is the story of a young man in the world that's coming, followed by two exclamation points, thus making it the only time I've ever seen anyone ever successfully pull off a two exclamation point sentence. Like, one is fine, three is crazy. I've never seen anyone do two. So I mean, that alone, that from enough. A grammar standpoint, I was like, This guy is treading new ground here. What's going on? Oh, this is insane.
And this is panel one of the book.
Right? Exactly. This is like page one. I was like, what is going on? But yeah, it's this really bizarre story about a future in which mankind attempts to solve his problems, solve world peace, solve what to do with one's free time, how to make meaning out of life with the idea that technology will fix these things. And it's alarming how not far off Kirby is. I mean, I think it's on page two, OMAC, or as he's known at the time, Buddy Blank, you know, runs into this. It's the IKEA version of a person, you know, assembly, some assembly required, you know, with instructions. And the thing says, you know, hello, put me together and I will be your friend. And I was just thinking to myself, like, in a really dark way, I think that's like somewhat not, it's unusually appealing to people that, like, you know, here's the easiest way to end up with a friend. It's just like, here's, here's, you know, how you can, you know, spend your time and have someone that you can hang out with. And I thought that was, like, really disturbing in a way. And I also really like that Kirby plays off of, you can tell that Kirby definitely pays attention to science, because this OMAC project is supposed to be like a subdivision of an offshoot of NASA. And it's this idea of that space satellites can become something more. And so you can tell that Kirby was obviously interested in, you know, what can space satellites do? How can they transmit data? What sort of things could they be transmitting? How would that influence people? You know, you can sort of see some of the gears going on in his mind about how to, you know, run science into this book. And of course, you have the idea that Buddy Blank is turned into OMAC by, what is it? I think it's the Global Peace, it's the GPA, Global Peace Association, something like that. Yeah. There's some really funny ideas there that I thought were kind of eerie, because these two guys show up because they're the ones that are in charge of, for the Global Peace Association, with deciding who will become OMAC, because they've been working on this project for a long time and they have to decide who they're going to transform into OMAC, and they pick Buddy Blank. And the scientist that they deliver the information to goes, you know, oh, you guys are doing such great work. It's a pity that I can't see your faces. And they've got these weird sort of blurry masked looking faces. And they go, you know, well, it makes us, they have this cosmetic spray is what they call it. And then they say, it makes us anonymous. We could be of any nation. And I was like, is this like anonymous? This is kind of like weird in a way. Yeah, it's almost like internet culture. I don't know.
I mean, if I could just, you know, jump in, I think what makes OMAC so interesting to me is that it is really pure Kirby, which is good and I don't say bad, but it's problematic in a sense, because
sometimes you can tell that maybe an editor would have curbed some of his, but I love it. I mean, that's the thing. Yeah. Like, sometimes it turns into a bizarre mess and you're like, with an editor, maybe this wouldn't have happened. And I can't decide whether that's a good thing or not.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating book because there's so much in there to pick out. It's just, you kind of have to look past or through all of the, you know, explosions and over the top dialogue, and to find the sort of interesting nuggets of ideas you're picking out here, Nick. But as the series goes on, this happens a lot in Kirby's DC work, and when he goes back to Marvel in the 70s, where he's almost creating too many ideas. Like, something will come up and you're like, oh, that's really interesting, and it just never gets mentioned again.
There's a
moment in OMAC where, like, hey, OMAC doesn't have any parents because we just made OMAC, basically. So they bring in two random people. It's like, well, we ran your numbers through a computer, and it turns out these people would be a good compatibility for you. So they're going to, here's your new parents. Here's your new family. And they are, like, never mentioned again. And it's such a strange idea. I just love that. But I think OMAC, again, is somewhat difficult to get into because it is so pure, unfiltered in a way, you know? I think it's my favorite Jack Kirby book because of that, but I enthusiastically recommended it to Nick, but I maybe more cautiously recommend it to people who have never read Kirby before, because it is very pure cut, you know?
It's very bizarre, and it's not unlike a lot of other Kirby stuff, and to modern readers, this will seem a little bit heavy-handed, a little bit ham-fisted, but he really does have social messages that he's trying to get across. You know, even in this issue, you know, the operative from the Global Peace Agency points out, you know, that violence, large or small, can destroy us all. One exclamation point at the end of that one, by the way. and if it's fascinating to look at Kirby's other works, and his social commentary is just, I mean, I read the Fantastic Four issue in that trade that was about the hate monger.
Yeah.
Which is obviously a not too subtle allusion to the KKK with the outfit. But then the hate monger turns out to be, why am I saying spoilers? This is like 40 years. This is like 50-year-old spoilers. The hate monger turns out to be none other than Hitler, or a clone of Hitler himself. Some of the things that come out of his mouth, you could just, you know, swap the hate monger with Donald Trump, or assume Donald Trump is the one wearing the hood. And it's like, wow, this is kind of modern society.
See, what I actually found really interesting about that issue of Fantastic Four was the way that the the characters treated each other when they were hit with the green ray that caused them to hate each other.
The H ray.
Like the, you know, the thing to me almost seemed unchanged, minus the fact that he wanted to beat up, you know, Reed Richards for some reason.
Yeah.
And like Reed Richards almost, he like totally flails like as a character. His character didn't know how to adjust to the hate. And so like he totally loses himself and he doesn't know what to do. And he tries these weak tactics. And maybe I haven't read enough old Fantastic Four to know about how Reed Richards used his power. But he totally failed as a hating character. Whereas the Invisible Woman just disappeared, which is great.
Yeah. She's just like, men are dumb.
She's like, this is all stupid and they're all dumb. And then, you know, Johnny Storm, he's like, well, I'm going to melt you into the ground. The thing, like, he just did more of the Human Torch stuff just against his friends. But he just embraced his pride. I thought that was like a really interesting take on those characters, seeing that they're supposed to be the wholesome family, and Kirby had, I think, probably the best grasp on them. And then to see them like all flip and do like a 180 to be like hating type characters, the fact that the Thing was more or less unchanged, like, just made me giggle as I was reading it. And I could not get over how well drawn the Thing was. Like, he's made up of all these different rocks and their shading, and like, even you look at modern takes, you look at, you know, everything about this character, I think Kirby's The Thing was the best by far. Like, just, he feels so clunky, and it works so well. I don't know. That was the one thing I took away from that. I really enjoyed the art in that book.
I think that's absolutely interesting. I've read a handful of that old Fantastic Four stuff. I tend to know more about the DC work that Kirby did, but then the Marvel stuff I've read, the Fantastic Four, he clearly identifies with Ben Grimm. Like, Ben Grimm is a stand-in for Kirby.
Right,
Because Jack Kirby...
Even the jawline, if you look at the jawline on Ben Grimm...
Yeah, I mean, compared to when Kirby drew Jack himself Kirby. In other books, he almost looks the same, just with rocks on his face.
It's so interesting. I mean, I love that. And reading those old issues, there's so much... Going back and reading them now by understanding Kirby's history a bit more, there's so much to take out of that. Like, I read the classic Galactus trilogy, you know, Fantastic Four, I think it's 48, 49, and 50, where Galactus shows up for the first time, the Silver Surfer shows up for the first time. Those comics still feel exciting, you know, 50 years later. Like, that's still exciting, energetic stuff, and it feels even different. And the character like the Watcher, like, that feels like a very strange character for the time even, and... That stuff that Kirby was doing, pushing what you could do with comics. And then the issue right after that, issue 51, is This Man, This Monster, where, like, Ben Grimm gets cured and he's no longer the Thing anymore, and, like, how that messes with his mind. And it's a very deep, emotional, psychological exploration of the character that you don't tend to think of Silver Age comics doing that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot, it behooves you, in a sense, to go back and reread that stuff, because it's great. It's not corny. I mean, it is at times, but there's a lot to nip you could pick out of there that's really interesting.
Yeah, so all you out there with those Marvel Unlimited subscriptions, go for it. Read those books and let us know what you think.
I was just shocked with that issue of just how many insane poses Jack Kirby was putting Mr. Fantastic into. I was like, buddy, if it was me, Mr. Fantastic would be like stretching his arm here or there, maybe like stretching his head a little bit, but like, he goes nuts with this issue. Like, he stretches his hand into the ground, into all the different roots, to like uproot this tree, or he stretches him into a road where the bad guys are like, I don't remember this road being there yesterday, and it's just Mr. Fantastic. Then he like rolls them up. It's absolutely just nuts how many just or the tangled mess he like, you know, wraps Ben Grimm up in, and I'm like, what are you doing, buddy? You're just making this job harder on yourself,
right? Like, like, he was purposefully drawing really complex panels throughout that entire issue, and I'm sure that it's like that in everything that Kirby's done. You know, I mean, all the other books that I've read with him, and I mean, it's wild the amount of detail this guy could put into a comic. And he, like you were saying before, Paul, he was churning out potentially 15 pages a week, depending on when in the, you know, in the time span he was working and how many books he was on.
Yeah, I mean, it's his output is incredible, which is kind of nice, because you can always find new Kirby to read. You think you've got it all covered, and sure enough, there's something else he did that you haven't read before. But yeah, I love the Kirby tech, you know, in those old issues where the machines just have so many weird little gears and parts that seem to serve no purpose. They're like, you know, just these things that Mr. Fantastic would be building in the Baxter Building. They're like three stories tall, this enormous machine. And it's like, oh yeah, that's just my coffee maker, you know, it's, but it's drawn with such amazing detail. I live for that stuff. I really enjoy that stuff. So it's cool to hear you guys sort of reading more Kirby and kind of digging at that. I would recommend, if you haven't, it's well worth reading his New Gods, the Fourth World stuff he did for DC. It's a lot of stuff, and it doesn't always work, but I feel like that's kind of his definitive work in a way. Because it really, if you read that, that's with Darkseid and Orion and, you know, the Planet Apocalypse and the New Gods, Mr. Miracle. That's Jack Kirby trying to create a modern mythology. You know, he's like, we have the Greek myths, we have the Roman myths, we have these Norse myths with Thor and all that. What are our myths that we could tell right now for our society? And that's what the New Gods are. And it's fantastic stuff. It's just so over the top. Plus, you get Jimmy Olsen, Superman's pal, through most of it. So it's a lot of fun at the same time. So
wait, what? Within the same book?
Okay, so yeah, this is something I want to make sure I pointed out too. It's not just Kirby's art, like I've been saying. It's his approach to comics in general. The Fourth World were four titles. You had New Gods, The Forever People, and Mr. Miracle. And when Jack Kirby got signed to DC, they said, you have to take over one already existing title. You can have your new books.
Yeah, I read an interview. They wanted him to take Superman, I guess, apparently. Yeah. That's what his wife said.
Mm-hmm. But he ends up, he's like, well, give me a book that no one's working. He didn't want to take anybody's job. So give me a book that doesn't have a permanent writer on it, you know?
Give me a stinker, basically.
Yeah. The story is that he's like, give me your worst-selling book and I'll make it your best-selling book. I don't know if that's really what he said, but they give him Superman's pal, Jimmy Olsen, is the fourth book. The first appearance
Rope
of
this into these other books of yours.
And the first appearance of Darkseid is in Jimmy Olsen, Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, number 185 or whatever.
What?
Yeah. Yep.
So, I did not know that.
So what's great though is, I mean, this idea that we kind of familiar with now, we were just talking about the Batman crossover going on now, but the idea that you could take one story and stretch it off across four different comic books, Kirby kind of invented that. You had the shared universe in Marvel. But the Fantastic Four stories took place in Fantastic Four, and maybe Daredevil would show up because they all live in New York.
Right.
This was really telling one big story in four different comic book series, which is something that had never been done before, and something that people do all the time now. Like, that was a brand new idea at the time.
That's wild.
You know, so that's what I really want to kind of stress here for this conversation. Obviously, there's plenty to talk about and pick out with Kirby's work, but like that relentless imagination for not just what you could do in comics, but what comics could be. You know, there's stories about him telling people in the late 60s, like, look, there's going to be a day when people just go to a specific store that just sells comics, or there'll be comic books in libraries, or people will publish novel length comics, like hardcover comics that people will like be reading. And in the 60s and 70s, people just laughed at him, like, no, this is just disposable culture, you know. But Kirby saw a bigger role and importance of the art form.
Yeah, there's another interview that I saw that Nick happened to find, and he sent it over my way as well, where it's about 5 minutes long, where it's just a straight one-on-one with Jack Kirby, and I don't know who was doing the interviewing, but...
Oh, Paul sent that to me, actually.
Yeah, okay, so yeah, Paul sent it to you, you sent it to me.
Paul.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and what I really loved about that is in the interview, he talks about that, how in the 60s and 70s, he was making predictions about comics and saying that he was trying to do new stuff because he wanted to essentially pave the way for people in the future, you know, as the next generation of comic people to push the medium even further. And one of the best moments in that interview was he talks about how, you know, we used to draw pictures and then we drew pictures next to pictures and we called that a strip. And then we put a bunch of strips on one page, we called that a page, you know, and then we put a bunch of pages together and we called that a comic book. Like, that just, like, the way he describes it, I'm not doing it any justice, so I'll insert the audio bit just to fix that.
The comic book medium itself is special. It's something that was, that's a result of evolvement. From what I understand, the editorial comic was first, and then they added a few panels to that and you had a comic strip. And they added a few pages to that and you had a comic book. And what we can add to the comic book? We may have to think about that. So I believe that's the interesting part of the entire field, is to say, what is it? Where is it going? How it'll evolve? And we experiment with that every day.
But the way he goes about that, like just the wonder in his eyes is so fantastic. Like I don't know when exactly that interview was done, but more it just like struck me in that moment. That whole interview is just gold. So yeah. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. But man, like the guy saw a future in comics far beyond what anyone could have imagined, and I think even more so now. You know, we think comic books are big and great now, but there is still room to grow, and like Jack Kirby is proof that it just takes like one person to push the bounds to actually show that this medium can do a lot more. It's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, as we've mentioned in several episodes of this podcast, I think we're all in agreement. We're kind of resistant to the idea of there being a specific codified comic book canon. Like these are the important creators and these are the important books. That said, you don't have comic books the way we understand them today without Jack Kirby. He's that important. I think we can't overstate his importance, you know?
Absolutely.
And I think it's important to have these conversations and go back and read this stuff and find these old interviews and find these kernels of knowledge that Kirby passed along, because he wasn't recognized at the time. You know, there's the famous story that he was at a comic book convention and a young creator, of course, I'm blanking on who it was. It is someone that went on to, you know, work in the comics. And he went up to Jack Kirby just sitting by himself. This is probably the early 80s. He wasn't working for one of the big two at the time. No one was really talking to him. He's just sitting at a convention by himself. The guy comes over and talks to him. He's like, yeah, Jack, I want to get into comics. Do you have any advice? And Jack Kirby just looks at the kid and says, don't do it, kid. Comics will just break your heart. Because his entire career was just so, you know? And there's these stories about him he couldn't go to a toy store. Because if he went into a toy store, he would see a Captain America action figure. He's like, yeah, I created that and I got no money from it.
Right. You know?
So it's heartbreaking, and there's this underdog quality to Kirby. I think it's that I find sort of hopeful in a way. It's like we've come so far as comic book fans and as an industry to kind of like correct these problems.
In a way, he's almost like a lot of those, you know, painters from past centuries where the joke was that you only get appreciated once you're dead.
Yeah.
And we don't think of that as like a modern phenomenon, like with modern pop culture and with modern art, you know. I think we don't think about it, but there's this idea that like people will see what you're doing and appreciate it, and you'll, you know, have fame within your time. And this idea that people won't, you know, discover you for 300 years and then be like, wow, what a genius. The idea that, you know, we're cultured and enlightened to a point where we can, you know, notice these changes in culture when they happen. And yet I think with Kirby, you do have another one of these situations where he wasn't appreciated, and or maybe to some extent he was appreciated, but he just got so utterly screwed over, and you know, not unlike the whole Bill Finger, what's his name, situation,
right,
over at
Bob Kane,
Bill Finger, yeah. Bob Kane scenario over at DC Comics. So, but that's, you know, that's really what it means to sort of delve into literary canon or literary critical theory and ask, you know, who are the silent voices, who are the people that were there, but we just, you know, they're not the ones that we remember.
Yeah, and the biggest unfortunate part about that is it's not that we're recognizing him after his death, because I don't think that's necessarily what it was, but
no,
I think that people started to only really recognize him, you know, after he, I don't want to say peaked, but after he was in his most prolific, fertile, you know, time period, where in the 60s and 70s, where he was just churning out comic books left and right and trying to break the mold of comics, as we've said. You know, it's unfortunate that it wasn't until probably the 80s or maybe the 90s that people really started to look back and go, oh, you can notice a trend. When this book started to come out, we saw a great change in comics, and it looks like it might come back to this one, or maybe these one or two or three people. That's the wild part to me.
Yeah, it's sad to look at how, like, a lot of the creators were saying, you know, it's not to say that Jack didn't like going to conventions, that he didn't like interacting with fans. Tons of the creators talk about how generous Jack was with his time, when these creators would just, and this is crazy in this modern day and age, these people would just show up at his house. They found his address in the phone book, and his wife would literally invite these people in. And they would just go down into the basement, which he called the dungeon, and he would just be drawing. And it didn't matter if he had the radio on or if he was talking to you or whatever, he would just be nonstop drawing, nonstop. And that's just, I don't know, that's interesting. But a lot of these creators have said, despite that, like, there was no reason that Jack should have been forced to, you know, in his older years, have to run the convention circuit. Like, I know a couple of them genuinely felt bad. They're like, if Jack wanted to do that, great, but he should have not been in a position where he felt he had to do that.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
But
right.
But he did.
Yeah. You know, and the point, I guess, kind of a summarization point, I guess, at this point, to just say that there is so much Jack Kirby material out there that I might be hesitant to recommend OMAC, but there's going to be something that sticks with you. If you're new to Jack Kirby or if you're well-versed, there's always going to be something new for you to discover. So, I mean, should we recommend some Kirby comics to people that might want to, you know, check this stuff out that may be new to it?
Hey, I mean, sure. I think for me, it's you know, I'm going to fall back on my, you know, in my safe zone. And I'm going to recommend that original X-Men story. Like that, just that those first couple of issues are just wild and fantastic. I mean, it's very 60s. It's very, you know, caption heavy, but at the same time, like you get the like the wholehearted origin of these weirdo characters that have these powers. It's mind-boggling to think that the comics that were coming out at the same time were just like horror comics, or they were detective stories, or, you know, just about plain everyday people. And then you've got the X-Men that show up on the stands, and that's gonna be wild. Like I feel like the number of that of issues that were sold for that number one were almost like a million or something like that. It's an outrageous number of comics that were sold just for that first issue of X-Men.
The X-Men, especially that original incarnation, are so weird. I mean, like you said, I don't think they were that popular until the 70s and 80s. I think the X-Men kind of like floundered for a long time because people weren't ready for that type of stuff. You know?
Yeah, I could be misremembering. I in my heart, I still place those early stories in a great place. So, you know, leave me alone, Paul.
No.
I'm kidding.
I think they stand out now because you go back like, wow, the X-Men, the fact that X-Men survived out of the 60s is pretty a testament to how strong the characters are because, yeah, those are strange comics for the time. So
totally.
I mean, I think I would recommend OMAC, obviously, but, you know, with the caveat, it is pretty weird. I think if you want to get into 70s DC Kirby and you're brand new to his work, you might want to check out The Demon, which was a series that he did. I think it ran about maybe 9 or 10 issues, and it's a Jack Kirby attempt to do a horror comic, and he invents the character Etrigan the Demon. And
oh, well, no way. Really? That was him? Yeah.
Okay. He invented everything, Nick.
I didn't know he was Etrigan, but that makes God, when you think about Etrigan and you know, he's this demon, but he's not really evil and he loves rhyming. Yeah, that does sound weird enough to be like a Kirby. That adds up completely.
I would recommend that stuff because it's not heavily, there's not a ton of canon along with it. I mean, the New Gods, I think, is a book that's worth your time to dig into, all of this New God stuff, but it is a time commitment. I think The Demon are just really fun sort of standalone stories that kind of show Jack's playful side and just the artwork, of course. I mean, that to me is his peak, that early 70s. He's just doing this sort of primitivism with his artwork where everything's just so abstracted, but it has such energy because of that. So that might be my, if you're brand new to Kirby, maybe check out The Demon first.
Yeah, I would still definitely say that I think I would recommend OMAC. It's standalone in a way, which I think helps. I think that's definitely a benefit. It doesn't have sort of that tie-in like New Gods does. But yeah, it's totally weird and it's definitely bizarre in a lot of inexplicable ways, but I think what I really like about it is that when you read that, it's like 100% Kirby, and that's not to say anything against his inker or his letterer, but really, you know, the ideas, the writing, the dialogue, the layouts, the pencils, you know, it's all unadulterated Kirby, you know, with no contributions from anyone else, and so it's just a glimpse of his, you know, vision in its totality. And I think that there's something valuable in that. I mean, there's a lot of other Kirby work where he's written stories that other people have drawn, or he's drawn stories that other people have written, even though I think if you look at a lot of the stories he was writing for Marvel, even if he wasn't doing the pencils, he was still technically in charge of the layouts on a bunch of those things, because he was actually the in-house artist for Marvel. And I mean, you know this, Paul, but like all of the other artists were being instructed to draw the characters based on his designs for I think like 10 years, they said. He was like the the art director, and so he was always the one that they turned to, you know, how does everyone need to draw this character, how does everyone need to draw that character. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to see Kirby in roles where he was contributing or collaborating, but especially in lieu of the stuff with Stan Lee, where it's like, well, who is doing what really? And it's like, who's, you know, your word against his, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. It's just nice to look at stuff that we can say, like, this was 100% Kirby, and right. I know that. And it's interesting to look at that stuff with that perspective in mind. Yeah. I mean, other than that, I would encourage people, like, if you like one Marvel character or another, just go dig up the original Kirby stuff. I think you'll be fascinated.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, Devil mm-hmm. Dinosaur was his. Mm-hmm. And I read mm-hmm. somewhere, I don't know if you can confirm this, Paul, but he originally created that character because he thought it was going to be, or there was talk that it was going to be turned into a children's cartoon. Have you yeah. heard this before?
Yeah. So as far as I understand, because his contracts with both DC and Marvel were so limiting, he wasn't getting paid that much for his contributions. He did a lot of pitches to animation studios. And actually, in the 80s and late 80s, and I think even in, well, maybe not into the 90s, but in the 80s, when he yeah. wasn't really working in comics that much, he was constantly pitching cartoon ideas. Like, not many of them got made, but I think Devil Dinosaur is one who's like, okay, this is a concept I could pitch as a cartoon, didn't get picked up, now it's a comic book, you know, that kind
of
thing.
It shouldn't go unmentioned as well that any of you who have seen the movie Argo, Ben Affleck's movie,
right,
where they get these people out of, I believe it's Iran, mm-hmm. with the idea that they're technically making a movie, a science fiction movie, and they use concept art from a film mm-hmm. to, you know, aid them in this illusion. Obviously, Argo is based on real events, and the artist who was drawing that concept art was Jack Kirby. Mm-hmm. I think the movie was called Lord of Light, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. And you can find it. We could maybe get a link so people can see the actual artwork that he drew. He didn't half-ass it. He drew some amazing artwork to trick these people into thinking they were making a movie. It's no stunning. Way. And the fact that he had time to do it right. in the middle of all this other comics. So, I mean, again, that's just a testament to his unbridled imagination and creativity. So,
was it specifically done for that? Not to split hairs, but I thought I read that it was actually a movie project that went under, but the art was already done.
Yeah, I think the movie was in a state of pre-production, and sure. then it didn't get made, and then they basically piggybacked off that for the rescue attempt to rescue the hostages. They had to use yeah. a movie that was already in development to gotcha. Make it seem worthwhile. So do we have some final thoughts to wrap up on? Do we just want to say thank you, Jack? I guess that's what I would say. Thanks, Jack, for literally inventing comics. So.
Yeah. I mean, inventing the modern day comic. You know, when Paul was in New York, I think I've told this story on the show before, but when Paul was in New York, we were walking around Lower Manhattan, and we had the address for Jack Kirby's old apartment where he lived when he was living in Manhattan. And we walked down there.
Where he was born.
Yeah, where he was born. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he lived there for a long while, didn't he?
Yeah, I think he grew up there, and then he did a lot of stories, I think, later on in some artwork about depicting what it was like to live in Manhattan, the Lower East Side. The fact that he did a lot of stories about gangsters, that he saw gangsterism up front in the 20s and 30s in New York. So, yeah, I mean, that was a pretty important place for him to grow up there.
And we went there. We stood in front of the yeah. door.
Mm-hmm. It was awesome.
Yeah, that was like going fantastic. To Mecca. Yeah.
Yeah.
my final thoughts, I mean, for Jack Kirby is just, take a look around you when you're looking at comic books, and just recognize like how much influence he's had and how iconic and like recognizable those characters are from his original takes on the characters. I mean, his covers, his just mm-hmm. his the way that he drew characters in general in action. Like it's unbelievable how influential one man's art could be on an entire medium. That's mm-hmm. that's the thing mm-hmm. that I always take away totally. From thinking about this guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, it's really the idea that he was always asking why should comic books have any sort of limits? You know, if you compare mm-hmm. comic books to music, if you compare comic books to novels, you know, you don't have people saying this is how you have to structure a novel or this is how you have to make a recording, you know, and he always said why should comic books stop evolving? Why should this medium, you know, dictate how things are drawn or how panels should work or how a story should be structured. And when everyone was, like I said, trying to make comic books quote-unquote more respectable by studying how muscles work and how that sort of thing could be realistically depicted on the page, Kirby was going and abstracting it. And mm-hmm. a lot of the people in that documentary were saying, Kirby is like Picasso. Kirby is like, you know, Goya. Mm-hmm. You know, he knows, as I think Neil Adams said, a lot of people thought that because Kirby was self-taught, he didn't understand how muscles worked or he didn't bother to spend the time. And as Adams said, like, those guys were idiots. Kirby perfectly understood how that worked, but he just wanted to abstract it. Because why are there limits? Why should there be? Why can't you draw things the way you want or write things the way you want, and that this medium is no different than any other pop culture medium out there? There shouldn't be any limits.
Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast. Our host, producer, and editor this week is Mike Rappin. Special thanks this week to Paul Jaisley and Nick White. The music in this episode is brought to you by Fantagram and Infinity Shred. You can find more Fantagram at their website at fantagram.com. As always, Infinity Shred can be found at infinityshred.com, as well as on Bandcamp at infinityshred.bandcamp.com, where their first track for their upcoming album, Long Distance, is available for listening. If you enjoy this show, tell someone about it. Rate us online. Write to us. You can reach us by email at ircb@destroythesaib.org. I know it's a weird email, but it's the one that we've got. You can ask us questions and comment on each episode in our subreddit at ireadcomicbooks.reddit.com. The entire podcast team is on Twitter, and you can follow the show at ircbpodcast. But a great way to experience the podcast and listen to our back issue bin of episodes is to visit our website at ircb.us. If you have a moment, please take a second and fill out our user survey at ircb.us/survey. We'd really love to get feedback from everyone who listens to our show, so please take a moment and fill it out. Until next time, from all of us here at the podcast, thank you for listening.